Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hi, I'm Chanti.
And I'm Lynx, and you're listening to Muses.
Enjoy the show. This week, we teamed up with our friends, Bethann and Leah from She Will Rock You, to present the story behind four short-lived but iconic girl groups.
This was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Shanti took inspiration from her name to give us the story behind the 1950s group, the Chantels. I'll be bringing you back to 60s Laurel Canyon with the GTOs. Leah shares the story of 90s alt-rockers Four Non Blondes, and Bethann has us reliving our teen years with Tattoo.
Yeah, she really does. Make sure you check out She Will Rock You if you haven't already. They not only educate on some of music's biggest names, but they also interview and promote new artists you'll be wanting to put on your playlists.
This is our second crossover with Bethann and Leah, and you can listen to our first by checking the show notes.
Enjoy the episode. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Nice to see you guys again. It's been a while. We've been wanting to do this again for so long. Finally, the time has come. Yes. Very excited about this. Nice to see you.
What were you saying? It was like
almost exactly 6 months. I was looking back and the last one was, it came out on September 3rd.
We'll have to keep it up. We'll have to like keep it a tradition.
Yeah, oh, I love that. That would be great.
It feels like just yesterday, but also a lifetime ago.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I was like, I could have sworn it was like last March.
Yeah, 2020 has skewed the timeline, and I'm not fully convinced we didn't go into a different parallel universe.
Time has no meaning.
Yeah.
It's true. That was a long year, a very long year. Yeah, we're out of it. Yeah.
We're out of it.
2021.
Seems
but
to
we're
be
gonna
okay.
go back in time with this episode.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we are.
Back
yeah,
to
taking
days.
Back to a different time. Well, we decided for this episode to pick a theme, and I think Lynx, you said, "Hey, I think I'm gonna do this group." I said, "Why don't we just do girl groups?"
Great idea.
Why not? I chose a girl group that I didn't know anything about and chose simply because we share a name, which
I appreciate
the Chantels, and it's spelled the exact same way. So I figured there are many reasons why we should all know this band, but I chose it out of vanity.
That's a great reason.
I say it's meant to be. It came across your path. The Chantels matched up. You were meant.
It's on our podcast, as we call the site.
Yes.
It's a sign from the universe that, hey, this is your direction.
Yes.
Exactly. And I don't know anything about them, so.
Me neither.
And, well, you did know, actually, when I messaged you and I said, maybe I'll do the Chantels. And then you were like, maybe. So at least you knew that that was one of their hit songs, which is more than I'm sure many people might know.
I love that song. It's a great song.
The Chantels were one of the first female R&B vocal groups to have nationwide success. So they're not just, you know, a girl group that happens to share my known name. They really accomplished a lot of really great and notable things. They were considered by many to have been one of the best girl groups because of their singing and songwriting abilities. They were active between the years of 1957 to 1962 in terms of recording albums together as a group. Those three albums are We Are the Chantels, which came out in 1958, There's Our Song Again, 1961, and The Chantels on Tour, 1962. Cool. That's going to be the name of my tour when I go on. The Chantels on Tour again.
Yes.
For the first time.
Oh, I love it.
So I'm going to tell you the names of the women, or rather girls at the time in this group. And I was surprised because I guess when I thought of kind of 50s and 60s girl groups, sometimes you just think of, I automatically think about the Ronettes, and it's just three of them.
Yeah.
But there were actually five members of the Chantels. There was Arlene Smith, who was the lead, Lois Harris, who was the first tenor, Sonia Goring, who was the second tenor, Jackie Landry, the second alto, and Renee Minus.
Wow, they got that, divided they up into parts.
First off, love for the tenor parts, the lower voice ladies. I appreciate that.
Are you a tenor?
Well, I mean, they put me on tenor for the Hallelujah chorus in by Handel Messiah in school. So, yes, it can be argued.
Shout out to the tenors.
Gotta leave it to a woman to do a man's job. Yes. That's all I gotta say.
Exactly. Well, their journey, their musical journey, began in their preteens while they were attending choir practice at St. Anthony of Padua School in the Bronx. By 1957, they had been singing together for more than 7 years.
Wow.
So unlike their male singers and male groups at the time, these girls weren't able to hang out on the streets practicing. So in 1957, much of the practice took place in the girls' locker room at their school, St. Anthony's. Arlene was a member of the girls' basketball team, and the group would sing after every game, even if they lost. They sang if they won, they sang if they lost. These girls were just always singing. Their unique sound was rooted in the music of the church, and also influenced by the sounds of the boy groups that did sing on the street together on the corners of the street of the Bronx.
It's interesting because I never thought about that, like you just said, about like doo-wop groups and everything that were on the street. Yeah, you never see girl groups doing that.
That's true.
Never thought about that.
Hmm. Yeah. Arlene was trained as a classical singer and had performed solo at Carnegie Hall when she was only 12 years old.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, damn. All of the girls had sung in the choir, where classical music was interspersed with Latin hymns. Their ages ranged between 13 and 16.
I love it already because they're already, like, you can tell, on the way to being prodigies. And it's like,
nah, we're going to make a band.
Just unite it even further into something spectacular.
And it was this mix of having this training, of practicing all the time, when and where they could, having this amount of time spent together. You know, we always talk about that sound when you get like sisters or brothers in a band, and there's like that blood, the what's it called,
harmonizing,
like like blood harmonies, but it's almost like if they grew up together from these like young ages too, then their voices are growing into one another. And I could imagine it would be something similar to sisters singing together. The girls would eventually form the group, and they would begin doing talent shows with the Sequence and the Crows at the PS60 Community Center and St. Augustine's Church. That year, their school team played St. Francis de Chantel. One of the girls suggested that they end their search for a group name by calling themselves the Chantels. They must have just thought, what a beautiful name.
That's what I think every time I hear it. So
this Chantel was spelled C-H-A-N-T-E-L-L-E, but they changed it to C-H-A-N-T-E-L, my exact spelling.
It was a great choice.
Great choice. And then at the end of my little segment here, I'm going to tell you a little bit about St. Jane Francis de Chantel. who has another Chantal spelling, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about that patron saint as well while we're at it.
Awesome.
Love it.
Might as well. Not only did the group have a very strong vocal presence, one thing that really stood out was the writing ability of the lead singer, Arlene Smith. So there weren't a ton of girl groups in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
There were even fewer groups who composed and wrote their own music and wrote their own lyrics. What made them special was this Arlene's ability to contribute both words and music, and the combination of her classical and gospel background with simple yet poignant lyrics, and these made her very successful at the very young age of 16. Her first song is called He's Gone, and that was written about a boyfriend just while she was practicing the piano. The Chantels began their journey to stardom in 1956 by a chance meeting with Richard Barrett. Richard was the lead singer of the Valentines, and they had met him on New York's famed Broadway. Legend has it that the Chantels were on the second floor of the Broadway building on Broadway and 53rd when the Valentines passed underneath the window. The girls recognized them and went downstairs to ask for autographs. During the conversation, of course, the Valentines would come to learn that these girls were a singing group. So Richard Barrett, who was the producer, writer, and arranger for and the Valentines' lead, asked them to sing for him right then and there on the spot under the Broadway Theater marquee.
Oh my gosh.
Magical.
He was...
Yes.
Yeah. You want to audition? Right here, right now. You got the job.
That's just written out of a movie.
I'd love to see this movie.
Yeah.
Oops. Take notes, Hollywood.
So excited. He was blown away, of course, by the sound of the girl singing a hymn. So that's what they chose. They chose to sing a hymn for him. But he knew that these girls were meant to sing rhythm and blues. And so he took their phone number. So T. Barrett recorded the Chantels on George Goldner's End record label. He's Gone, backed by The Plea, were released in 1957. So here's some cool stuff about this band, if this isn't already cool enough. He's Gone instantly set a new standard of quality for female group recording. By September 30th, the record was on the Billboard National Top 100 charts, but it stopped at number 71, just for no particular reason. It just stopped at 71. The record charted only 7 weeks after the Bobettes hit the top 100 with their first release of Mr. Lee. Ironically, these two trend-setting groups of the 50s only lived a few miles apart. I don't know if that's actually ironically. Like, that actually probably makes sense. They grew up in a similar environment, right time, right place. And then the next release, which was Maybe, became a major hit all across the nation, and it made the Chantels stars. Here's another cool thing about them. The Chantels were also credited with recording the first extended play 45 RPM record. So essentially, they were the first girl group to record an EP.
Whoa.
Wow.
That's cool.
That's so cool.
And then they recorded a second EP. So they were pioneers, really. Yeah.
Well, because EPs weren't really a thing in the 50s yet. Yeah. Like, it's not till we get to really the 60s and 70s that we start seeing them a little bit more.
They began a series of nationwide tours with Alan Freed and Murray the K. Kaufman. They also appeared on Dick Clark's American Bandstand. Although the Chantels were one of the first female vocal groups of the rock era to have an album released under their own name, they were dropped by End in April of 1959. That same year, George Goldner's record company folded, and so the original singer Arlene Smith struck out on her own. She went solo. The Chantels did keep moving forward, and in 1962, released what was to become the group's highest charting record, Look in My Eyes, on the Carlton label, and Annette on lead under the direction of Richard Barrett. So he stayed with them as well. This was followed by the up-tempo Well I Told You, which was a top 20 hit with Barrett on lead, and it was actually the answer to Ray Charles's Hit the Road, Jack.
Ooh.
In recent years, and I'm saying like 2000s, 2010, 2011.
You're telling me 2000s is a recent anymore?
I do. Especially if you start in 1957.
Yeah, okay.
That's very true.
They toured and they played at the world famous Apollo Theater, Radio City Music Hall, the Beacon Theater, the Tarrytown Music Hall, and the Norfolk Music Center. Oh, as well as the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Nice.
Nice.
Yes. They were inducted into the Vocal Group Hall of Fame in 2002. In that same year, they were inducted into the Bronx's Walk of Fame, where their name was officially posted on a street sign at the Bronx County Courthouse.
Very cool.
In 2001, they made the final ballot for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but without enough votes for induction, unfortunately, which is bullshit, because we know that's all...
It's all politics. It's all
bullshit, anyways.
We have I have my gripes about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
It's all politics.
Yeah.
Just like any other kind of award thing, definitely politics. I mean, when you think about all the amazing people who aren't in there, that should be...
Yeah. Well, the big... Oh, sorry.
People who are that maybe shouldn't, or...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the biggest one that really always ticks me off is for Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who is arguably the creator of rock and roll.
Yeah.
They didn't induct her till like 2018.
Isn't it an honorary induction?
And it's
too?
An honorary induction. It's not even a real induction. And I'm just like
how?
Here are all these people that she inspired, and you're not going to honor like the creator of it? Okay. Cool.
Nah.
Anyway, Mind blowing.
Exactly.
Wow.
I was very pleased to find out that the Chantels have an active website.
Ooh.
That's impressive.
This is them. It's a picture of, you know, four of them. And it says, one of the things on their own website says, these extremely talented ladies are also featured in the celebrated Doo-Wop is Alive photo unveiled on February 3rd, 2000 at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. as a salute to the pioneers of the rhythm and blues and doo-wop. They were greeted as the sweethearts of the era.
Aww, that's cute.
You can also purchase CDs and t-shirts from their website, which I need a t-shirt that says the Chantels.
Yeah. You need one.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Quickly, I'm going to tell you about who St. Jane Frances de Chantel is. The invoked patron of forgotten people, widows and parents who are separated from their children. So I like this. When people criticized her for accepting women of poor health and like old age into her like home and or convent or whatever it was, Chantel famously said, "What do you want me to do? I like sick people myself. I'm on their side."
Oh, I love that.
So if it was this Chantel that they were named after, she seemed pretty cool. And I hope that, as always, giving a little bit of background on the pioneer of a certain kind of music genre, especially being a woman in this genre, inspires people to listen to their music, check them out, go on their website, buy a t-shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many amazing girl groups back then that did maybe only have one or two hits. And so therefore they're just less remembered as opposed to like the Ronettes or someone like the Supremes, right?
Yeah.
Like, but they were still so pivotal and important and helped pave the way for those artists.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed. Yeah, for sure. That was great. Thank you very much.
Look
Thank
at their Chantel. Website. They're
oh,
just adorable.
Oh my gosh, yes. This website is awesome. Sorry, she
oh,
pulled
the
up the website.
Isn't it?
We have two computers going. So.
Yeah, that's adorable. Oh, I love them.
I love the changing photo behind them.
Yeah, oh,
that's amazing.
It's legit.
I love it so much.
It hasn't been updated since 2012, but
that's
I love
okay.
it.
I can tell by the web design, but I'll forgive them.
I love the mirrored reflection too.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh!
Everyone has to check out the website.
Yes,
thechantels.com.
It's thechantels.com.
Keep it simple.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hi, I'm Jenny Owen Youngs.
And I'm Kristen Russo.
And together, we run Buffering, a rewatch adventure, a family of podcasts moving through our favorite 90s genre television. We talk about iconic shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The X-Files, and even some current TV like Yellow Jackets.
Buffering has been praised in places like Time, Esquire, Paste Magazine, and The New York Times, and we've chatted with dozens of cast members, writers, directors, and fans along the way. Come hang out and rewatch some of your favorite television with us and a wonderful community of listeners.
Learn more at BufferingCast.com or find us on socials at BufferingCast.
I guess I'm next.
You're next. Yes.
We're going in chronological order.
In order here.
I'm going to take us about a decade up from the Chantels into the late 1960s. I'm going to cover the GTOs. And they're very interesting as a group because they're sort of a performance art girl group that had an album. I'm going to go through each member one by one at the end. I'm going to talk about them all as a whole. But I guess I should mention, first of all, that Pamela Debar was probably the biggest star out of the group. We've covered her many times. She wrote I'm with the Band. She's our mentor. We love her. Aww.
And she brought us together.
Really?
That's how Lynx and I met, was through Pamela, was through a GTO.
So cool.
So cool. Yeah. And we have multiple episodes on Pamela herself, but we've never talked about the GTOs as a whole. So I really wanted to pay tribute to them because they were amazing.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. So in the late 60s, a group of seven beautiful rock and roll obsessed young ladies came together in Laurel Canyon and on the Sunset Strip, and they kind of formed their own little troupe. At first, they called themselves the Laurel Canyon Ballet Company until their friend and musical mentor genius, Frank Zappa, suggested that they change it, to the GTOs. And the GTOs stands for Girls Together Outrageously, but they also liked playing around with the name. So it could be Girls Together Only, Girls Together Outlandishly, Openly, Overtly. There's just endless possibilities there, and they like to play around with that. So one of the things that the GTOs had in common was their great passion for music and the men who made it. So they were actually a groupie dance troupe. And they became pretty well known around the Laurel Canyon and Sunset Strip scene for their outrageous vintage outfits, their wild and free dancing. They'd go to all the shows, The Doors, Zeppelin, Zappa, and just dance their hearts out. And after a while, people were like, oh my God, who are these amazing women? It was more about them than it was about the guys on stage, right? Yeah. Their creativity attracted all kinds of people, all kinds of musicians in the scene. And if you look at their photographs from that time, you can really tell how much they inspired so many bands that were to come out that had like a visual look to them, such as Kiss, and Alice Cooper was hugely inspired by them. They were actually the ones who put Alice Cooper in makeup and his band. They actually made his look for him, basically. And credit to Alice Cooper in his biography. You can check out his documentary. He does credit them.
That's so great.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, another person who was really fascinated by them was Frank Zappa. And they really spent a lot of time in Laurel Canyon at his cabin. And two of the GTOs actually became nannies for him over the years for Frank's kids. So he really loved their spirit. He saw a lot of talent there and really encouraged them to dig deep. He was telling them, you should be writing, creating, performing. Like, you have something here. You have a spark. Do something with it. So they really banded together and started writing, and they performed together on stage as a group a handful of times, most notably in 1968 at the Shrine Auditorium. They opened for Alice Cooper and Zappa on the Mothers of Invention. And people really loved their groupy, feminist performance, art, rock kind of thing. And Zappa thought, you know what? There's enough here to make an album. We should get these girls into the studio and see what we can do here. They were really encouraged by him to write and share their ideas. He really wanted their spirit to be a part of this album. He didn't want it to be like his album. It's their album. In 1969, that album was released. It was called Permanent Damage. And it's an interesting album because it features both spoken word pieces mm-hmm. and performance pieces and original songs. So there's, I think, 17 tracks on the album, and the lyrics are like as wild and out there as their outfits are. I can see Shanti going, yeah. The ooh man. Yes, exactly. The most famous out of the GTOs, Pamela, in her book, she said, I wanted to ignite people's imaginations and make life a playground. And I feel like that's exactly what they did with this album.
I love that.
I'll give you a sampling of some title songs. As Shanti just said, I'm in love with the ooh, ooh man. Circular circulation. I have a paintbrush in my hand to color a triangle.
That's a great title.
Yes.
Right? The Eureka Springs Garbage Lady. Just very interesting. I mean, you can tell it's the 60s. You can tell they're, I guess, having fun with some drugs. And
definitely.
They're letting their imaginations go wild. They also have a track on it called Rodney, which is, of course, a tribute to Rodney Bingenheimer.
Nice.
They recorded with Zappa in his studio. And since Frank was such an inspiration to so many other musicians at the time as well, a lot of people would come over to his house and just to hang out and, you know, mess around in the studio. So there's a lot of guest artists on this album, such as Rod Stewart.
Wow.
Davy Jones.
Wow.
Jeff Beck. All help out on this album. That's Cynthia crazy. Plastercaster, another famous groupie. They were also attracting other attention, of course. In 1969, they caught the eye of Rolling Stone and photographer Baron Woolman, who featured them prominently in Rolling Stone's groupie issue, which also shows you just how prevalent they were.
I have first off, I didn't know they had a groupie issue back in the 60s, but it also awesome. Sounds amazing.
It's awesome. And yeah, that's the thing. Like, these women weren't groupie. The term groupie, as we know, kind of got muddled over time, but they were stars. Everyone wanted to meet them. It wasn't like they were chasing after musicians. The musicians were like, whoa, who are these women? I want to chase them. Right?
I love that.
Right? And yeah, photographers wanted to photograph them. Everyone wanted to know about them and what their scene was like. So they really got a lot of attention. But unfortunately, within a year or so, they kind of disbanded, mostly because a lot of them had issues with drug addiction. They were also so young and like meeting people. They moved around a lot. It just wasn't the right time, I guess, for them. And Frank Zappa, as we know, wasn't really into drugs and everything. So he didn't want to pursue a working relationship with them unless they were all clean, sober, I guess. And that just wasn't the right moment for a lot of these people.
And yeah, we're not saying just like, you know, some pot and like the occasional acid. Like, there were some heavier things going on, right?
Yeah. Like, absolutely.
Like heroin and...
the heavy hitters.
More intense stuff.
And of course, like, that's where his kids live and everything, the studio, and he just didn't want that to be around. And I guess he probably saw how that destroys relationships, careers, and by telling them like no, he was probably trying to help them be like, you don't need that in your life, like do this. But they kind of disbanded and they each went off on their own way. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about each member now and what sort of happened to them after the GTOs disbanded. So first there was Miss Christine. She was born Christine Ann Furka. It's F-R-K-A.
Furka.
They need a vowel in there.
It's kind of hard with a vowel, so I think it's right. Vowel is good.
I'd like to buy a vowel.
So Christine was born in 1949. She was actually the original nanny for Frank and Gil Zappa for their daughter, Moon Unit. Great names here.
Oh, yeah. Moon Unit.
Yeah. Christine is also the muse on the front cover of Frank Zappa's 1969 album, Hot Rats.
Okay.
She also dated Alice Cooper, so she was very influential in his world at the time when he was building his band. And, of course, brought all those girls into that scene as well. After Alice Cooper, she also dated Todd Rundgren and Sparks frontman Russell Mayall. Sadly, Miss Christine ended up passing away just before her 23rd birthday in November of 1972.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Next, there is Miss Lucy. She was born in Puerto Rico and she can be seen in three of Frank Zappa's films, 200 Motels, Video from Hell, and Uncle Meat. I've only seen 200 Motels, but I want to see all of these just because of the titles.
Uncle Meat is just perfect. That should be a band name. And I'm like, just like a hardcore band name. And I'm going to be very disappointed if I find out there's not one named Uncle Meat.
Right? I'm surprised there isn't, because it's just,
I'm going to start a folk band
called Uncle Meat.
Uncle Meat?
Yeah, banjo band.
I could easily see it working for that as well.
Yep.
Yeah. So Lucy ended up marrying bass player Gordon McLaren, and he was in a band actually called The Groupies.
Oh.
Right?
Perfect match.
She was married to him from 1971 to 1981. Unfortunately, Lucy has also passed away. She died in 1991.
Oh.
Next, there's Miss Sandra. She was born Sandra Lynn Rowe in 1949. She's probably best known as the pregnant GTO. She had a big belly on display in the GTO's publicity photos for the album, and she had a big black star in the center of her belly.
Hell
and
yeah.
Around her eyes, again, with Kiss, right? That's mm-hmm. obviously heavily influenced Kiss. Sandra lived in the Zappa house. And the father of her child was Frank Zappa's artist in residence. His name was Cal Schenkel. Hmm. After the GTOs broke up, she went on to marry and she had three more kids. She also passed away in 1991 from cancer.
That's so sad.
Jeez.
Yes. There's a lot of that in this, unfortunately. Next, I have Miss Cinderella. She was born Cynthia Sue Wells in 1952. She was the youngest member of the GTOs. In 1971, after they disbanded, she ended up marrying musician John Cale, who is best known, I guess, from the Velvet Underground. And he also produced a lot of people like Patti Smith and others. Mm-hmm. They divorced a few years later, around 1975, and he wrote a song about her called Guts. I think she cheated on him with another musician, and he wrote about it in the song and put it out.
Makes
Cynthia
sense.
Ended up passing away in 1997.
Man.
Yeah. Now we're going to go on to Miss Mercy.
She was Miss born, Mercy.
Right? I know.
Yeah.
She was born Judith Era Peters in 1949. She was actually on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine in February 27th of 1968. One of the first issues ever, I believe. She was described as by Alice Cooper as a gypsy and the Mae West of the group.
Ooh.
So put a gypsy and Mae West into one. It's a perfect description of Miss Mercy. She was also best known, I guess, for her coal black raccoon eyes that she would do. Very heavy on the lid. I guess one of the first I can actually think of who did that. That became a look later. But she was definitely one of the first. She was married to singer-songwriter Shuggy Otis. He did Strawberry Letter 23, if you guys know that song.
Okay.
Probably his most famous. And they had one son together named Lucky. So Mercy had a really wild life filled with drugs and rock and roll and musicians. And after leaving Laurel Canyon, she married Shuggy. And she really became a part of this R&B scene around Stax Records and that sort of life. In the late 90s, that's when she started to get clean finally and really started a new path for herself. Mercy and Pamela were actually best friends until the very end. Mercy sadly passed away last summer, actually.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But she left a gift for us all in the form of a memoir. Her book is going to be named Permanent Damage after the GTO album, and it's set to be released in June of this year.
I just got goosebumps.
Yeah, I'm so pumped for this book. She had a crazy life, and I'm sure we'll do like a whole episode on her when it comes out. But yeah, she's fantastic, and I'm so glad she got to write her memoir before she left us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I got two more to go here. We have Miss Sparky. She was born Linda Sue Parker in 1948. So her and her fellow GTO, Miss Pamela, they attended high school together.
Oh.
Sparky was best known for driving her Hudson Hornet up and down the Sunset Strip in the late 60s. And of course, she'd have all the GTOs in the back and their get-ups just hollering at people out on the street and, you know, causing a scene wherever they went. She provided vocals and sound effects for Zappa's 1976 album, Zoot Allures. And Sparky is still alive, but she's a very private person and enjoys her private life. So that's all I'm going to say about her. Last but not least, Pamela DeBar, Miss Pamela. She was born Pamela Miller in 1969. She is a very successful writer. She has 6 books now.
Wow.
Her first, of course, being the bestseller, I'm With the Band, in which she shares her coming-of-age story, being a groupie in the 60s and the 70s. She's had relationships with musicians such as Jimmy Page, Keith Moon, Noel Redding, Jim Morrison, Chris Hillman, Graham Parsons, Will and Jennings. She's just tops. She's tops. And of course, she was married to singer, songwriter, and actor Michael DeBar. They had one son together. She's probably known as the world's most famous groupie. She's worked hard over the decades to eliminate the stigma around what it means to be a groupie and owning your sexuality.
Yeah.
She's, like I said, Shanti and Mai's mentor. She now does writing workshops. She travels all over. I've been going for around 10 years now, and it's honestly one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. I've met so many incredible women throughout this experience, so awesome. Like Shanti. And if she's ever coming to your city, I highly recommend
go. If she's coming to Virginia, I'm definitely wanting to go meet her. She seems incredible.
She's amazing. And the women that flock to her are all just brilliant, talented. It's insane the amount of talent in these classes and in the community. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Before we ended the GTO part, I just wanted to say I got most of this information from Pamela's book, I'm With the Band. And our other good friend, Lucretia Ty Jasmine, she wrote a piece on the GTOs in a fantastic book called Women Who Rock, Bessie to Beyonce, Girl Groups to Riot Girl. And like I said, we have interviews with both Pamela and the editor of the Women Who Rock book, Evelyn McDonald, on our podcast. So if anyone wants to know more about those, you can check them out there.
Awesome.
Amazing. I love hearing about the GTOs. Even though I know the story, I'm just, I love hearing it.
Yeah. I love how much they owned them. Like, just, they wanted to have fun. They wanted to be free, and they were young and causing a scene everywhere. I can so picture them. So yeah, I just wanted to pay tribute to them. They might have only put out one album. It's very hard to find now, but if you can, get it. You can find their music on YouTube, though, for anyone who's interested.
Awesome.
Gotta love the internet.
Yeah. All of those women are so amazing.
It's definitely experimental.
That's like, okay.
It's not... let's just say they weren't a classically trained Chantels.
They were a performance art group.
They were performance art group.
Considering Poppy just released a whole album, Music to Scream To, I think I could handle it.
Yeah. And it's very of its time. Like, I'm so happy that Zappa was smart enough to capture like that moment in history. Mm-hmm. He was really smart like that. There's only one GTOs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's only one Laurel Canyon in the 60s, and he captured that perfectly. So it is a fascinating piece of music history.
Definitely. I love it.
It was awesome. Great job, Langs.
Thank you.
You guys definitely had a theme across your two topics. We have a theme across our two topics to be revealed. We're going to change gears here in a whole different lane. Still a girl group lane. We're fast forwarding to 1990 and talking about Four Non-Blondes.
Take me there.
Love it.
So the year is 1990. Grunge is a thing. The California scene has a very distinct vibe. And these four girls kind of said, fuck the vibe. We're doing what we want and we're making a lesbian band. So they formed the band and we have Linda Perry on lead vocals and rhythm guitar, Shauna Hall on lead guitar, Christina Hillhouse on bass, and Wanda Day on drums. And so these four ladies, I don't know where I was going with that sentence. I want to start with pointing out before we even get started that the internet does not like this band name. They hate it. Every resource I found has, I don't know why, but they're like open message boards that let people comment on stuff, like, because it's, you know, the internet. And my favorite comment was, this is totally ambiguous. They might as well have called themselves four people who aren't wearing black sweatshirts.
I felt that on me, too.
Wow. So they named themselves Four Non-Blondes because, like I said, there was a very distinct, like, California preppy culture at the time. And the four of them were just, like, hanging out on the street one day, just vibing. And Christina Hillhouse said, right next to us, there was a trash can with a piece of pizza on top. And this kid wanted to pick it up. And the mom said, no, it's probably dirty. What with all the pigeons and the people around here? And she stared right at us because we were non-blondes. As a non-blonde, I feel this.
Yes.
So they named themselves that as kind of an anti-Californian stereotype, which people in 2021 don't get, apparently.
Yeah.
I think it's clever.
All that aside, they started in San Francisco, like I said, in around 1990, and they gained traction at a time when record companies were looking for authentic female rockers who could kind of cross over into that pop bubble. They kind of just started up touring the San Francisco bar scene, specifically lesbian bars, because they are all lesbians, and unsurprisingly, most of their followers were also lesbians. They eventually landed a record deal, and their first rehearsal was supposed to be at 6:10 p.m. on October 17th, 1989, but shortly after 5 o'clock, the Loma Prieta earthquake hit the San Francisco area, and they weren't able to have band practice.
You know, it'd been more punk if they would have still had band practice in it. I'm a little disappointed at this point.
It should probably have been a sign that their band was not going to last very long, but we'll get there in a minute. So, in 1992, they're recording their one and only album, Bigger, Better, Faster, More. And the album's producer, whose name is David Tickle.
Mr. Tickle.
He decided that their guitar player was not happening. And so he fired her.
Oh, wow.
And replaced her with a man.
What?
Yes.
You can't have four non-blonde. No.
He's not blonde, but he's only in the band for this album. Like, he never tours with them and never does anything after this album.
Okay.
But they replaced him with another man. So this kind of bends the girl group thing a little bit, but whatever. Like I said, they only have one album, and it contains their best-known song, What's Up, which is why I chose this, because it was viral on TikTok for a hot second over the summer.
It was? I missed that.
Yeah, people would like film themselves getting out of bed and then just going outside and screaming over the what's going on part, because let's be real, we all felt
it is fitting. It is fitting for the past year.
We all felt that last summer. When Linda Perry was writing this song, she just ad-libbed the lyrics. They like flowed out of her and she kind of just had someone write it down, and it was what it was.
Wow.
She was very inspired by the political climate of the time. George H.W. Bush was the president. She felt like she was always struggling. There was some kind of always some fucking political mess in the news, and she just kind of felt like, why is all this happening in the world? But there's no like direct lyrical reference to any of these things, which is what makes it so applicable in times like 2020 when we still have the same problems.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever done that song for karaoke?
No.
I cannot hit those notes. Like, I can't even attempt to.
My sister-in-law can.
Ooh.
That's impressive.
Yeah. And very all nice. Of her three sisters. And I've done karaoke with all of them.
Ooh.
That's impressive. I would never choose that song myself, but power to them. And this song was the first ever top 40 hit by an openly lesbian group. Interestingly, the Indigo Girls never got higher than 52.
Really?
Yeah.
That surprises me. Wow, yeah.
Like I said, they're all open lesbians, and Linda Perry often performed with a sticker affixed on her guitar that just said dyke, which got her a lot of hate, but props to her for being loud and proud in 1993.
Yeah,
no absolutely.
It also got her a lot of hate after she performed on TV at the Billboard Music Awards and on Late Night with David Letterman.
People suck.
It's the 90s.
They still suck. I know.
They probably, honestly, they were ahead of their time. If they had tried 100%. To make this band now, they would explode.
Well, but just think about all the queer artists that we have right now. They're just killing the scene. Like, absolutely slaying the scene. Yeah. You needed bands like Four Non-Blondes.
They set the stage, but I get the feeling they didn't quite agree as a creative team either.
Yeah.
Which is my next point. They disbanded in 1994. 5 years after they started. They had started recording their second album, but they never finished it, and none of that music ever saw the light of day. Linda Perry said that she kind of was unhappy with the process of Bigger, Better, Faster, More, which, when your producer fires your guitarist, it's not a great creative vibe going on in there. And she said that her sexuality actually had a huge part to play. She was, you know, a super out lesbian and had no problem being out. But the other two, Krista Hillhouse and Don Richardson, were less comfortable because it was the 90s, because people were really mean to them and really, you know, hateful to them. And they didn't like her being so upfront about it. And so they just all decided to go their separate ways. She went solo in 95. But she's had a much more successful songwriting career. She's written songs for Christina Aguilera, Alicia Keys, Pink, Gwen Stefani, Courtney Love, and Kelly Osbourne. She did form another band called Deep Dark Robot.
Ooh.
Which is a great name. And it came to her after she'd been writing all these songs for these, you know, top 40 artists. And she wrote them from really personal places. And no one wanted to record them. So she just kind of said, I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then last point, on May 11th, 2014, the group actually reunited for one day to perform a benefit concert at a fundraiser to raise money for the LA Gay and Lesbian Center that takes in kids who have been kicked out of their houses by their family. And That's cool. is the very short history of Four Non-Blondes.
That makes sense now. I don't know why I only know the one song, of course.
They kind of just have the one song.
And it's so good, but then, you never heard of them again. But I knew that Linda Perry, you know, writes for so many big artists. So I guess that makes sense now,
She's a really accomplished.
They couldn't have continued on together, though.
Yeah,
I mean, none of our groups so far have had huge, Chantel had three albums. You know, GTO's had Permanent Damage, and then so they were all really influential and really important for what they did, but they didn't necessarily have the longevity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also hate the album name, Bigger, Faster, More.
What is it? Yeah. I don't even remember what it is, and I just read it off a piece of paper. it's not a good album name.
No.
I feel like that title was written by a man.
Probably.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, yeah.
Bigger, better, faster. Bigger, better, faster, more. Okay. It's Mr. Tickle's fault.
Continuing on the theme.
The theme of lesbians.
The theme of lesbians.
I can't wait for this one.
Okay. So before researching, here's all my 2000 elementary school brain knew before. Knew the song All the Things She Said and Lesbians. And of course, I'm talking about Tattoo.
Schoolgirls.
Yes.
Making out.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what I know. But it turns out, as I researched, very complex web to this story that we somehow have to abridge. But like all wild...
They're not wild
lesbians. What was that?
Maybe they're not...
Plot twist.
Plot twist. They're not lesbians. Well, they're not schoolgirls, and they're not Swedish.
Damn it.
Episode over.
Take it away.
Well, like all wild stories... We start with a man in Russia. His name is Ivan Shapovalov. Help me.
Shapovalov?
Shapovalov. Thank you.
Shapovalov.
I have a kind of a little bit of a speech impediment, so sometimes I have to look at her and be like, how do you pronounce it?
Names are always the worst.
Yeah. Especially Russian names.
Yeah.
Especially
also,
Russian.
Lings, I didn't want to say anything at the time. But was the album called Zut Alors? That's French.
Oh, it might have been.
I think you said Zut Alors. Zut Alors is like fuck in French.
Ooh.
It's like
I
shit.
Said Zut Allure.
I'm going to write that one down.
So that's like.
What is it again?
It's Zut Alors. Zut Alors is like.
Zut Alors?
That makes French perfect sense for Zappa. Thank you for that.
I like that. So, Ivan. Is wanting to form a teenage girl group in the 90s group boom. And he whittles it down to Lena Katina and Julia Volkova. Now, Lena and Julia do know each other from a kids group called Neposetti, which I'm assuming is like the Mickey Mouse Club of Russia. That's really the only way that I can describe it. But so he signs on the two girls. And they start recording music in Russian. But first, let's talk about their name, because that is really going to set up the story and where it's going to go. So Tattoo, while sounding like tattoo in English, it's supposedly a shortened phrase in Russian called Ta Lyubitu, which translates to this girl loves that girl. But it was selected by Ivan. So the wheels are turning. Why is Ivan choosing this name?
I feel like Ivan is real creepy.
Yeah. We'll talk more about Ivan. But
I don't like him.
That's the setup. So due to time, because we can just talk about how they started in Russia, went over to America, we're just going to jump right into it and talk about the song. Yes. The song in Russian, Yashola Seuma, was released in 2000, which translates to I've Lost My Mind. And it was written by an Elena Kuiper, which my brain has labeled her as the Russian Ellie Kemper from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Just thought I threw that in there, how my mind works. But she wrote the song about an experience that she had. She went to the dentist. Okay. She went to the dentist. She fell asleep at the dentist. And as she fell asleep...
I think we're all giving you the same look right now.
We're all like, where is it going?
Here we go. So when she fell asleep, she had a very scandalous dream for Russia, may I just say, where she kissed another girl. And she woke up out of that dream. And in the dentist's office, she says, Yashola, whatever. I've lost my mind is what it translates to. So that is how the song was written. Which
dentist chair.
Okay.
Yeah. In a dentist chair. But of course, The lyrics are about a young girl trying to hide her feelings for another girl. This song would go on to be released in America and UK and Canada with the new title, All the Things She Said. So let's talk about it. Because first off, I'm assuming everyone on this chat has seen the music video at some point in their life.
I also have a story about this song.
Oh, good. Okay.
So couldn't get away from that video when it was on.
No.
It was like the video everyone was talking about at the time.
As much as my Christian parents tried to shield me,
MTV
somehow made its way into my life.
MTV was still showing music videos at that time.
Yeah. But essentially, for those who have not seen it, it is essentially singers Lena Katiana and Julia Volkova making out and people watching them behind a fence. And they're in Catholic schoolgirl clothes, just as a nice touch. Fun fact, it was actually filmed in Russian, like they were in Russian, and shot in Moscow, and then dubbed for English, which I did not know. As far as for the video, it is so controversial for 2000s. I mean, holy crap. Like, at first, it was banned in the UK, and of course, you know, Russia, as it promoted lesbianism, dun dun dun.
So four non-blondes walked so that tattoo could run.
Another criticism was it promoted pedophilia because they were 17 at the time. Like, I got news for you. Like, if you don't think there's like teenage girls kissing, I hate to break it to you.
I had news for you.
The thing that more promotes pedophilia was Ivan specifically looking for a teenage girl.
Now, that is correct.
It's creepy.
There's some truth to that. But then the song begins to tackle the charts internationally in countries like Australia, Germany, Italy, Japan, Norway, just to name a few. Shanti, I need to know your fact about this song.
Oh, okay. So, well, two things is one, I follow lots of 90s nostalgia accounts and like early 2000s.
Yeah. Don't we accounts. All?
And I saw the performance that Tattoo did at the MTV Awards or whatever it was, mm-hmm. and had all the schoolgirls. But my actual, and I went, oh, yes. But my actual story is that when my younger brother was in high school, the high school installed a jukebox. And he would get to the cafeteria in the cafeteria. And so he would get to the cafeteria early at every lunch hour and put enough money into the jukebox so that it played, so that his pick played throughout the entire lunch hour. And he would put Tattoo's All the Things She Said on repeat for the entire lunch hour. And then he'd stand in front of the jukebox machine and like nod his head.
That's pure chaotic neutral energy.
Yes.
What's that?
So that's pure chaotic neutral energy. He's just like,
that's what happens when kids didn't have cell phones.
Who's installing jukeboxes in schools and thinks this is a good idea?
I wish my school had a jukebox.
Yeah, I do too.
Look,
but
the jukebox was gone the next year. I think this
I love that so much.
Because there were teachers that had to like monitor the lunchroom, right? And it drove the shit, like it drove everybody crazy.
Amazing.
It drove everybody out of their minds, if you will. So they got rid of the jukebox.
Incredible.
After that because of my younger brother's antics.
Obsession with Tattoo.
I love that so much. Now imagine if that was Spotify. They would have made a shit ton of change off of your brother. Well, at this point, getting to our story, they're just becoming a sensation. And of course, late night TV takes notice. So in an article from Junkie that I read, they talk about an event where the duo went on the late night talk show with Jay Leno. But of course, this is 2003, and they get pulled aside, and they said, hey, tone down the lesbian. Oh, and don't talk about the war. So what do they do?
Both of those things.
Correct. They wear matching shirts in Russian, so us Americans don't know, which is smart, because we don't have the energy to go look up things. But it roughly translates to fuck the war. Mm-hmm. And in between performances, they make out behind a hand. So while this duo is on top of the world, it is around this time, around late 2003, where everything starts to change. A Russian TV documentary comes out called Anatomy of Tattoo, and it drops these two bombshells. One, they're not actually lesbians. Two, one of them's pregnant. So at first, the band denies it, but it's 100% true. So let's go back to our friend slash comrade, Ivan.
Ivan, you have to say for yourself.
So you see, when Ivan recruited the two members, there was supposedly a contract. And to loose paraphrase it, it said, you are now lesbians.
And yeah. What the heck?
And basically, for the next few years, they're told what to say, how to act. It's just all a show. And this is because Ivan and his business partner had thought of tattoo after watching a Swiss movie about two schoolgirls who fall in love, which we see in All the Things She Said. We see that influence there.
Running through my head, running through my head, yes. Running through my head.
So, as you can imagine, this has torn up some fans in the LGBTQ community, especially in Russia. Now, I read several articles from different music magazines, all of which are written by queer artists as they recounted hearing the song and feeling like they were understood. I also read a blog from a Russian author that said, quote, all the songs perfectly depict the condition of a gay teenager raising in a homophobic society. And this was after the author spoke about the gay propaganda law that passed in Russia in 2013. So it's an interesting thing because at one hand, I see how they really helped a lot of people struggling with their identity. Mm-hmm. You know, find acceptance. Yep. On the other hand, I think in today's standards, they would be viewed as co-opting queerness for a cash grab.
Yeah.
And I think both points are absolutely valid, in my opinion. But yeah, we cannot deny, like I said, that song helped a lot of people in the LGBTQ world, including Russia. So what happened to the duo? Well, they did 5 albums total.
Wow, they did the most albums out of anybody.
Wow. I mean, none of them are really well known. They're kind of just there. But from 2001 to 2009, the duo split in 2011, and each of them went to go do solo work. So let's talk about each of them real quick. Starting with Lena Katina. Now, she does some pride work and plays at different pride events, which is awesome. In 2007, she helped with a pride parade in Moscow before the gay propaganda law went into place. We're okay with Lena. Still mad she faked being a lesbian, though, but at least she's throwing lots of support to the community. And, you know, that's all I can say.
She's trying.
She's trying. Julia, on the other hand, I'm just going to say this. In 2014, she is invited onto a Ukrainian game show. And the host asks if she would accept her son if she would condemn her son if he was gay.
I don't like where this is going.
Yeah. And she replies, yes. She says, I would condemn him because I believe that a real man must be a real man. A man has no right to be a word I'm not going to mention. She then justifies by saying two women could get together. Completely different, though. Ooh. The two men get together.
Mm. Sounds like what my aunt says after like 5 glasses of wine.
You know, there's a lot of truth to that. And, you know, like the next thing fits that category because she tries to fix it. And she says, quote, I have many gay friends.
Oh, no.
That's what they all say.
That's what they all say. And then she goes on. I believe that being gay is still better than being murderers, thieves, or drug addicts.
What?
Yes. So in case you're wondering, she is 100% wrong. She is 100% canceled. And we do not like Julia anymore.
That is so crazy.
Go to heck, like, Julia.
So
her whole
exactly.
career, she profited off of the idea of like gay culture being something that she's present in.
Uh-huh.
Now. Yeah.
Though she has plenty of gay friends.
It's okay.
Don't forget. It's okay. Oh, God.
That is so upsetting.
Bad enough she said that, but also, what kind of question is that when you're on a game show?
Ukrainian game show, too. I think it's called Lie Detector. I think that's where they got her.
Oh, okay. Ooh. That makes a little more sense. I'm picturing, like, the Price is Right type game show. Yeah. And they're just like, hey, while we're on a commercial break, what would you do if your son's gay?
Final Jeopardy. What would you do if your son's gay?
There is no wrong answer.
Oh, God. So anyway.
That's interesting that...
It sucks. It really sucks. Because don't you realize that literally you've... I think when you... First off, it was wrong that they co-opted queerness. I have personally a little bit of an issue with that. But on the flip side of the people who were inspired by them, like, you now kind of have a burden to them to support them. You can't come crashing down their life by being a shitty human, but apparently you're just going to be a shitty human regardless. But anyway,
you know. Gay men are men. So
yeah,
period.
Yep. Exactly.
Ivan sounds like the Kim Fowley of Russia to me.
Yeah.
Just like taking young girls and being like, we're going to sex you up and throw you out there.
Yeah. I think exactly what you said. He was trying to be that. He's trying to be like almost like a Phil Spector. Like, I'm going to be the next Phil Spector. We see how well that ended. What was that?
Yeah.
Lou Pearlman.
Yeah. The Lou Pearlman. Yes.
I don't like Ivan.
Those people. Good riddance to them.
Yeah, for real.
That was a lot of fun. All of those stories.
It was. And it was also interesting. I'm glad we did it in order, because it does help see the progression of women in music, you know? And I think everyone that we talked about sort of took a risk in what they were performing and what they were presenting to the world. So it was fascinating. I was really, really enjoyed this.
Well, I think I'm sorry. Go ahead, Shanti.
I was going to just ask everybody if they have a favorite girl group.
Ooh.
Maybe if you want to do a modern one or just one of all time. I don't care.
I would have to say L7 is my favorite girl group. I guess they're not a girl group. They're like a band, but they're a group, right? So they count.
Yeah. That's okay. Yeah.
Why is the only thing coming to my head is Barlow Girl?
No, don't say that. Mine is the Veronicas.
Ooh, that's
I love
a good
the
one.
Veronicas.
That's a good one.
Oh, you know, I was actually going to, with the name the Chantels, I was going to be like, there's actually a couple of other girl groups who have gone on to name themselves kind of similarly. So like the Veronicas, the Donnas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, things I love like the Donnas as well.
Yeah.
They're
great. So good.
I'm obsessed with Haim.
I do love them.
I think
this modern one.
It's hard for me because my brain just keeps defaulting back to
Barlow Girl.
Do you guys know who Barlow Girl is?
No.
It is a sister group that is in the CCM, which is contemporary Christian scene of the 90s and 2000s.
Church kids know.
Even though I'm not a church kid anymore. My brain is already trained to think that way.
My phone still tries to play Barlow Girl sometimes.
Gray's my favorite color.
Yes.
Is there music like very Christian inspired, or would you not know really?
They're definitely one of those bands that aren't like, all their lyrics aren't just like, you know, we praise you. They're more just like, here's a song that doesn't quite break any rules, and your parents are gonna let you listen to it.
CCM is a wild world. Like, it's actually one of my goals to cover CCM, because it's literally, they're trying to compete with secular music, right? And show like, oh, we can do it, right? And in the 90s, it's actually like, some of it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm like, damn, like, you got some bangers. And then the 2000s hits and everything just starts to suck.
Things get weird.
But then you have a emergence of Christian rock bands that are...
A la Skillet.
Yeah. That are just like... The goal is to show this music to your friends and trick them. So it's stupid, but that's unfortunately the mindset. And then you get the Christian hardcore scene, which is like, F you, F the world. But hey, I'm going to tell you for 5 minutes real quick, we believe in Jesus Christ. All right, F the world.
And okay, now next crossover, everybody bring your favorite Christian group.
Yes.
But anyway.
That could be a wild episode.
Dude, it is on my list because it's just, now it's just, what's crazy is a lot of the artists are leaving Christianity altogether. It's a wild, wild ride. It's because of how the industry.
Yeah.
How the industry was
or
formed.
Or they're deconstructing their whole faith and coming out as lesbian, like one of my favorite artists.
Yes. That's another one. So anyway, it's just a wild thing. But if I had to choose one off the top of my head, Tegan and Sarah.
Oh, right on. Okay.
That's great.
That's my backup after
Canadian homegirls.
Right? Yes. Yes.
Sisters.
Warp Tour, Tegan and Sarah, man.
I have one short Tegan and Sarah story I can tell you. They performed at a venue that I work at, and it was one of the... I've worked in venues for 15 years, and it was a Tegan and Sarah show that I saw one of the worst violent incidences happen.
Ooh.
These two women just...
Ooh, damn.
After each other, like blood. We had to call the cops.
But Tegan and Sarah are so chill.
I know.
I don't understand.
I know.
They had some beef with each other.
It's, yeah. Yeah. It was an interesting. And now every time I hear Tegan and Sarah, I'm like, I remember the visual of these women.
That's
like,
hilarious. Man.
No, it's never the shows you think it's going
to
be.
No. I mean, as someone who used to go to the hardcore scene all the time in high school and college, it's just like, I expect to see a fight or two. Actually, I'd be disappointed if I didn't see a fight
bloody
or two.
Nose here and there.
Yeah. But like at a chill concert, I mean, I'm coming to vibe. I'm not coming for a fight.
No. Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, this was fun, guys.
Yeah, I loved this. This was so great. And
it's so nice just hanging out with you guys.
Yeah. We love you guys so much. We're always trying to promote you guys when we get a chance, just because we feel like you're our podcast sisters in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
We love you too. Keep doing what you're doing. And I can't believe how much we've all still been doing in this last year. So
I know.
Wow. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Muses is researched, edited, and produced by us, Chantelle Mew and Lynx O'Leary.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.